Session number 27345, Reel 6.
So it's Jordan, Reel 6. So you're going to show in Haifa. Did you have any chance to have any recreation ashore while you were doing the patrols? That kind of period?
No.
Just to school and then back?
Yeah. You had your recreation on board. You had your games. And you had your tombola. You played Arcus. That's... You know it as Ludo, but it's called Arcus to us. And you'd also watch the old shipmates of 2 and 3 badges that had done their time, and especially those that had been in the China station playing Mahjong. Fascinating. And of course, you used to play cards, whist, solo whist, and everything like that. But no money ever was on the table, you wasn't allowed. But so we used to play for points. And you probably play for about 2 months. Then you'd add up all the points. You'd have some bad hands, good hands. But when you come to work it all out in the end, there was only possibly about 30 or 40 points between the one in the front and one at the end. So it all came out, you see. And so, but no, we used to keep ourselves occupied.
Was there any restrictions on your movements as a boy seaman, really, on board? Were you able
to... No, because I passed the boy and I was an ordinary seaman. If I had, we didn't have any boys. Destroyers too small, you couldn't have a boys. It's cruisers and battleships have boys, because they have the boys' mess and everything else, and they are kept apart. You know the obvious reason for what. Yes. But no, you were a young ordinary seaman, you were still watched over. Oh, yes. He was still watched, Ella.
Sounds kind of paternal attitude towards everybody.
Oh, yes. And you would get involved, and you would get talking to the, as I say, the three badgers, we used to call them. And the yarns they used to tell you, you know, because when there was on a China station then, it was a 5-year trip. Not 6 months and back, it was 5 years. Mediterranean was 3. When you went to the Mediterranean, you got 3. You was going to stay there for 3 years. You see, so and some of the old boys that had been to Singapore and places like that, and they used to tell us quite a few tales, very enlightening. And I did have actually a 3-badge AB, and he was just. A 3-badge AB. He had no qualifications. He was just an able seaman. And he showed me a lot of the ropes. Put me right. He was the one who helped me pack my locker first. They sort of take you under their wing. You know, nothing nasty concerned. They just help you on your way. Because they had to go through the same system. And they always helped you. You could always ask for help on board ship. Always.
Do you feel now that was the right way to do it within our services to help people come on from...
Oh, yes.
...early on?
Oh, yes. It is. When the RVO got sunk and I went on HMS Franklin, I was an LTO on the HMS Franklin, and we had quite a lot of new people come on there at times. You always helped them out. I was only an able seaman LTO, one badger. But you always helped somebody because... all of you were green. You didn't know. You were coming from a barracks where you'd had a certain amount of training, but you were going into an entirely different environment when you went on board ship. Everything changed. But you remember your training.
Is there a lot to learn? So when you went on the Ivanhoe, is there a lot to learn?
There is a lot to learn on the destroyer. And you poke your nose in for everywhere. You want to know what this is and that is and everything else. And you take note, you watch.
And that's expected of new crewmen, is it, to try?
More or less, yes. To ask questions and find out what they're doing. And they always, in your station, in the starboard watch, or port watch, whatever the case be, all the young ones were all the lookout, because you were so young, and you had good eyesight. Your eyesight was better than possibly a man that had done 12 years. And he was all, that was all young, ordinary seamen with the lookouts and young ABs. That's how I came to be on the bridge.
So I'm going to ask you a little bit about that, because obviously while you initially were on the Bosun's, were you on the Bosun's party initially when you got onto the boat, or was that slightly later?
Well, when I was on the island, I was made bosunry, the side party, and I stayed side party right until she got sunk. But I also was attached to the seaman, the torpedo branch, at various times.
How does the watch system work on board a destroyer?
You have a port and starboard watch. It's half ship's company, port, half starboard. And that peacetime, that's broken up. You have first part or second part. First part of starboard, second part of starboard. And that's how they used to, when you used to go to sea, they used to close up the first part because there were sufficient men to run the ship while he was just going to sea, travelling. Then if things were tense, as they got to during the war, then you were doing port and starboard. Port watch, starboard watch, port watch, starboard watch. Four on, four off. And that's what it was. From the start of the war, we started on four-hour watches. And I never came off a four-hour watch until I retired from the Navy.
So how's that divided up then, the four-hour watches into the day? How do they work?
I'll start from noon. You have the afternoon watch, then you have the first dog, second dog, first watch, middle, morning, forenoon. And that's how it used to be.
Why are the dog watches called the dog watches?
Dog watches break. If you stayed on the same watch, you'd do the same watch permanently. You see, but by breaking it up into two hours, you broke the system. So when you was on the first and morning watch, which was from 8 till 12, and then from 4 in the morning till 8, the next time you come round, you'll be doing the middle watch. You'd be sleeping from 8 till 12. You do the middle watch, and then you go back to your hammock at 4 till 8, or till you're ready to get up. And that was the object of the dog watch, to break it up. Otherwise, you'd permanently be the same. You see, you'd permanently be on the forenoon, or you'd permanently have the middle watch. So this way they broke it up. And if you had the middle watch, because it was so disruptive to your sleep, you usually had to make a mend the following afternoon. At a rest.
And what would you do during the make and mend times?
Well, a lot of the older ones used to have little cat naps and everything else, but I suppose I never got used to it, not for a start. I was too, being only just 18, I suppose, and coming up for 19, I didn't want to sleep. I sort of took it in my stride. But you could sit and read, and some of them would be playing cards and things like that.
So you're at sea, and it's your watch.
Yes.
And you're with a bosun's party.
Yes.
What would you be doing then? If you're not on exercise and you're just patrolling something.
Well, you'd be on watch. You'd be, what, your side party would be finished, because that is the, that's your duty when you're not steaming, right? Unless you are required, of course, but which is very rare. But you'd be doing your proper watch. And you'd be on the bridge, or you'd be attached to the torpedo party.
So say you're on the bridge, were you acting as a lookout?
Yes.
What did that involve, actually?
You scan from 0 to 90. Then there'd be another one. There'd be four lookouts. You'd be on the front. I was on the bow. And then one behind me. He would do from 90 to 180 on the starboard side. Then on the port side, you would have the port lookout coming in from 180 to 90. And then you would have the fore lookout from 90 to 0. And that's how it went.
And what were you on the lookout for?
At peacetime, it was just ships and things like that. Because wartime, it was a different thing altogether. you were looking for periscopes and things like that.
In the peacetime, though,
and
would you,
planes.
Would you shout out if you saw a ship?
Oh yes, you say ship bearing so and so, because you had a marker. On the bridge was the marker, so you could, and the binoculars there, and you just look down and see it. Ship bearing 040, sir. And you'd give him the compass reading, 040. Or one astern. If he saw something round about right astern, he would come out with ship bearing 180 degrees, sir, astern. Because you all had this little, the binoculars were on a stand, and because it made it easier to look. And at the base of the stand was the areas, 0 to 90, 90 to 100. And that's how you had a little lever, pointer, and as you turned your binoculars, so the pointer would tell you where you were. And that's how you stand.
Was it tiring to keep your kind of...
Very tiring, because you couldn't keep looking through the glasses all the time. It used to draw your eyes very, very much. And actually, you used to have some of the officers on board, and they would say to the lookout, take five minutes, rest. But you was on and off all the time. You had to do what you thought was right, and how your eyes took to it. But they did draw, and once you'd done a 4-hour watch, you knew you'd done it looking through glasses, your eyes were a bit sore. Then you used to go down to the sick bay and see the sick berth attendant, and give you a little bit of wipes, you know, to wipe your eyes. With some, I don't know what's in, you know, these eye drops sort of stuff, but he would give it to you on a little bit of lint, and you just wipe your eyes or something.
Is it a useful thing, though, to kind of learn the rules of the sea and
oh, yes. I mean, when you were steaming, I can remember one, what was it? Oh, if to your starboard red appears, it is your duty to keep clear. You see? You're going along, and if to your starboard another starboard light appears, it's up to you, because it's up to you to keep out of the way. And he would be doing the same, he'd be keeping out of the way.
And although you're sort of acting as a lookout on the bridge, you are learning, are you, how the ship functions?
Oh, yes, because you'd listen to the officer of the watch giving the instruction. And then you would hear altar calls to so-and-so, and then you would hear the officers down to the wheelhouse, 5 degrees starboard. And you put 5 degrees of starboard wheel on, you see. Or if it was more, or harder starboard, whichever, amidships, meter, meter, because you're going that way, and you put it in midship, so you can port, you come back, and so you're trying to offset the way you're moving, and all of a sudden you say meter, and you and Helms would look down and say so and so, and that was the course you got.
And apart from you lookouts, who would be on the bridge with you?
You'd have the officer of the watch, signalman, and lookouts. And ASDIC operator, to watch the ASDICs, and the navigator, and sometimes the captain. Captain will come up at any time. Captain on the bridge. Then you just done a little bit more careful, when the captain was about.
And you said the ASDIC operator was up there. Where was he on the bridge?
The ASDIC operator, he used to read out the readings. But the operator himself was down in the actual operating room. He would only read, because he would help if he was tracking the submarine. He would be helping the captain, who would obviously be on the bridge, ready to drop depth charges, things like that, you see. So he would save the captain having to look at this. He would issue the instructions from the Essex.
So the Ivanhoe must have been one of the first destroyers really with ASDIC at that point.
Oh yes, she had it, yes.
Did you do
it? But she was built in. I don't know when she was built, but it was built properly in.
And did you do any exercises like anti-submarine?
Oh yes.
Exercises?
Oh, quite a lot of that.
Prior to the war occurring?
Oh yes. And you used to do it with real subs. the subsum that were stationed in Malta used to go to sea, and we used to try and track them down. Submarine detection. Oh, yes.
So you must have heard quite a bit of that when you were doing a lookout on...
That's right. That's how I came to... Because you'd hear the instructions being passed to the quarter deck for preparing depth charges, depths and everything else, because all that came from the bridge, the captain, because the ASDIC operator would tell him where the submarine was going, its speed it was going, and its estimated depths. And then from that, then the captain would estimate the depths he would drop his torpedoes. So if the sub's around 80 feet, or 70 feet, he would put on about 120, so he'd have it drop beneath it, then he'd have the other ones, they would be done by the throwers, and then he would have the other ones that just rolled off the back, say at about 50, and that's why you had to get out of the way quick, because when they got the 50 up, they went, you had a great big spout of water. You had to be very careful, you know.
How successful were you in those anti-submarine exercises?
Pretty good. They were pretty good. They were pretty good. Yeah, so we used to enjoy doing that, and I used to like it, actually, because, you know, when I was on the starboard watch, you used to do the exercises, and not at action stations. It used to be done by the watches. And when I was on the bridge, my ears were always tuning up, listening, because I wanted to know, especially about the depth charges, because, as I say, I was attached to the torpedo party, because I wanted to know a lot more about it, because it's all torpedo men that do the depth charges. See, that's another part of their job, was the depth charges.
So really, in a sense, torpedo men are really almost the people who do all the kind of offensive ownership, aren't they? So
yes.
Not just the gunnery, which is reactive.
Well, they're responsible for the gunnery circuits and everything else, you see. And if really necessary, you've had a certain amount of training, you could go onto the gun and become a gun's crew. But those guns crew couldn't always become a torpedo man.
So prior to the Second World War, would you say you were quite confident in the ship's kind of ASDIC capabilities, that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. Very good. Very good.
So how long were you in the Mediterranean?
I joined in the February of 39. Age 18, and because I got drafted to it, you see, I went out by troop ship. And that's when I told you when I picked up the Ivan. I suppose I was out there about 9 months, but I learnt a lot. I did learn a great deal.
Were you out there when the war started? You were both going away.
I'm going to come to that. At the end of August, we were due to come, the flotilla was due to come off home and pay off. She'd done the 3 years. And so we all flew our paying off pennants, which is a very, very long pennant. And it flies right at the top, and it's about 50, 60 feet long. You're paying off, you're going home. Because, I mean, I was pleased going home again. And we were in the Bay of Biscay coming home on the Sunday morning that war was declared.
How did you hear of it?
Over the tannoy. Captain announced it, that we were now at war. And he announced that we were at war, but we would be still going home. And then later on, during the day, we got our instructions, he said, and we are going to Scapa Flow. And that's where we arrived, back in Scapa Flow.
Had you thought that war was coming at that time?
Well, I think people knew something was up. You know, we knew the situation because we got all the signals and everything else, what was happening and so forth, and buzzes used to go, rumours used to fly like lightning, you know, and because when he invaded Poland and everything else, we knew, well, we all knew, because we knew what was going on. Of course, our skipper used to keep us informed.
What was the atmosphere on board when the declaration was made known?
Well, everybody was sorry, very sad about it at the time. But I suppose being being as a teenager, I suppose, as I say, I still consider myself a teenager, although the Navy considered you a man when you turned 18. I was still apprehensive quite a bit. But anyway, we arrived in Scapa Flow, and the first thing we was told that we would be escorting HMS Courageous. And we was in Scapa Flow, and we oiled, refitted ship, so far. And then a week later, we arrived on the Sunday, and we arrived in Scapa Flow on the Tuesday. And then on the following Friday, after we'd oiled and victualled, we went to sea with HMS Courageous. Four of us, four destroyers were escorting them. And we went right up to the northern tip of Ireland and Scotland, right up at the edge of the Atlantic up there. And Courageous was steaming at about 15 knots. On the starboard side was the destroyer in the front and the destroyer at the stern. On the port side was the destroyer up the front, and at the stern was HMS Ivanhoe. And that's how we were steaming. Of course, our Aztecs were going all the time. And this was on a Sunday. And it's the practice on the HMS Ivanhoe that you always relieve the last dog watchman a few minutes early, because he hasn't had his supper and he's hungry and wants to get down. So you always, you didn't wait till 8 o'clock, you got up there about 5 to. So this is how I come to be on the bridge so smart. I relieved him about 5 to and took over on the bridge, and we were just steaming. And all of a sudden, captain on the bridge, and it was skipper had come up, because we were looking out, and I was watching HMS Courageous, actually. And then all of a sudden, I saw two explosions on the port side of HMS Courageous. The skipper, "My God," he said, "it's the Courageous. Time." And I automatically watched my watch, 8:01. Of course, you can quite understand, a bit of a panic on board, down to the Aztecs was being called. I mean, sweep so-and-so, sweep so-and-so. The destroyer in the front was doing the same. And we were, because the torpedoes came from our side. Actually, the torpedoes came between the leading destroyer and us to hit the Courageous, because she was in the middle. And the other two destroyers had lowered boats to pick up survivors. And of course, I'm looking at the Courageous. And all of a sudden, about 30 seconds after, there was another explosion. And I don't think they clarified it as another tin fish, but they thought it was an internal explosion. And they think this is what blew the bottom. Well, it always happens when ships get sunk. I've seen a few ships been sunk, and their siren always blows. I don't know why, but it always blows. And Courageous' siren was blowing, but somebody turned it off. It was making a horrible noise. And I was watching, and the flight deck, within a space of about 2 minutes, it sank from being dead straight to an angle of 45 degrees. Down, because all the support had been blown out. I could see men starting from the top down the flight deck into the water. By this time, the Courageous had come to a full stop, and there were men jumping off her stern, off her bows. Men were jumping everywhere. And I watched. And when she came to a stop, she seemed as though she didn't know what she was going to do. Then all of a sudden, she started to tilt it over. The weight of the flight deck being down near the sea, began to pull her down. and she began to turn. After about 10 minutes, and she was very, very slow on this turn, and all the time men were jumping off. Then her propeller appeared out of the water, and the bow was going down, and she was like that. The bow hadn't gone under, but her stern was sticking high. And she sort of held that position, I don't know, probably 5 minutes, I suppose. Sort of held that position, and then all of a sudden, she decided to roll a bit more. And then there was a terrific rush of air. You could hear it, a hiss. What everybody summarised and what we all spoke about was that there was an airlock holding the stern up, but the weight of the water in the bow and pulling her down finally won, and this air escaped, and this great hiss, you could hear it. I mean, we were no more than what, half a mile away, and you could hear this hiss. And after the hiss, she just slowly went down and she disappeared. And the first lieutenant was on the bridge at the time, and he said, "She's going, sir," to the captain. And the captain shouted out, "Time!" And I automatically looked at my watch, and it was 23 minutes past 8. So it took her 22 minutes to sink, with a loss of 670 lives. We, in the meantime, were doing airstick runs and everything else, and the other two destroyers were picking up the survivors. We carried on. And then about an hour later, the first lieutenant came up on the bridge, and he said, "Who took the time?" And there was three of us took the time, and we told him, and he said, "Yes, we all agree that was the time." He said, "But it wasn't 1 minute past 8, and it wasn't 23 minutes past 8. He said it was 20:01. It was 20:23, naval time. So we were politely told off that we had logged it at one, well, that was it. He politely said that's what it was. And we carried on to the following morning, more or less, trying to find this, but he was clever. He knew he'd got a winner, and he tin-fished her, and he moved away smartish. We never found it. And then we returned to Scapa Flow. And then from Scapa Flow...
Can I just ask, with that, what was the purpose of Courageous's patrolling at that time?
She was patrolling for the... At that time, she was patrolling all up north because of the convoys were starting already. And she was, in actual fact, on submarine watch, because she was... Aircraft were going off, and the aircraft were searching the seas. And that's as far as I know. But being an ordinary seaman at the time, I didn't really know what... that's what we understood. It was submarine watching, and also for convoys.
Were there any aircraft airborne at the time while you...
No, it was 8 o'clock in the evening, because everything was... She was just going up. It was getting dusk, and so she didn't put any up. And that was it. We went back to Scapa Flow. There was, we was asked questions. We had to go down to the first lieutenant and was told what we'd seen. And everything worked out that everybody said the same. And just returned to your duties. And we, within a week, we was back escorting ships.
Had the episode been quite a sobering episode, obviously, because you'd just gone to war?
It frightened me, because it was the first thing I'd ever seen about war. And to see all those men sliding off and in the water, I never realised. I was too young at the time, I suppose. But once it had happened, then I realised what war was. And then I think I grew up.